My name is Webb Smith. I'm an alcoholic. Being asked to speak at an AA meeting is like being asked to have sex. If I remember correctly. My sobriety date is July 2nd, 1984, and I was born April 6, 1950. So the arithmetic is easy. But it really is because, you're delighted to be asked. You're nervous about your performance. Usually if you relax, take it easy, think about the other guy, things go pretty well. Everybody has a good time, and when it's over, you can have a smoke. So thank you, Monica. I'm an alcoholic, and you know, I'm selfish and self-centered in the extreme. So if when I'm done, y'all like me, that's a success. If you like me and you think you might be like me, that's even better. If you like me and you want to be with me, we should talk. But I have a minimum age of 40. And that cuts this room down to that poor, pitiful old Dick Drysdale. I really like Dick, but not that much. So I am an alcoholic, and that means that. It means a lot of things. I've come to understand that left to my own devices, there's nothing so bad I can't, nothing so good I can't screw it up, and there's nothing so bad that a drink won't make it worse. And I have to keep that in mind. It means that I'm powerless over alcohol, and my life is unmanageable. It means that. If I want to recover, I know that that's true. And so I have to be able to do an inventory myself. When I started out, before I got to AA, people were taking my inventory for me. And I imagine that other people have had that experience. You know, your mother, your father, your lovers, your boss, the police are all telling you that there's something seriously wrong with the way you're behaving. But you don't believe it. Alcohol saved my life. Alcohol is a gift to mankind from God. Alcohol is a part of God's perfect world. Normal people drink normally. And they love to have a drink. It says in the doctor's opinion, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. And that's he's talking about everybody, all men and all women. Alcohol is a wonderful, wonderful thing. It's a social lubricant. It means in the big book? Joy and conviviality, right? Release from care, boredom, and worry for normal people. And it really works for them. It really does. So what sets us apart? And again, there it is in the doctor's opinion. It's the phenomenon of craving, which doesn't mean I really want a drink. It means once I've taken a drink, I have no effective control over how much I take from that point on. And I had to understand that was true about myself before I was available for this program. I had an inkling. I mean, so July 2nd, 1984, I woke up. I had a big fight with the lucky girl that was my girlfriend at the time. Left the house, slept on a friend's couch with a quart of Jack Daniels and woke up with about half of it left on the table in front of me, and just said, you know, I can't do this anymore. I had reached the point where most every night I was room spinning drunk, and I was laying there with a foot on the floor to try and keep from puking, and I was praying to God to give me cancer, because I knew what an alcoholic death looked like. I was in training as a physician at the time, and I saw lots of alcoholic deaths in the ICUs with the puking of the blood and the yellow and the swelling up and the horrible, horrible things that happen to alcoholics when they die. But what really affected me was watching these people's families and seeing them. And, you know, there was always grief, but I always saw a sense of relief. I always saw people saying, if they didn't verbalize it, it was there. Thank God that's over. And I didn't want to go out like that. I figured I was young and still relatively good looking, and if I died of cancer, people would say, what a shame, you know, he had such potential, you know? Instead of, thank God that's over. I was really, really miserable. So I ended up going to a treatment center, and as I walked in over the thing, there was a thing that said, expect a miracle. And I broke down in tears. If it had said, work for a miracle, I probably would have run away. But that's what this program is all about. It's work, but it's a tremendous amount of fun. So, I'm old and I've acquired experience, and I'm sort of chagrined to say that my experience has come from making mistakes. And I'll tell you the first mistake I made. There's a trap in alcoholism. There's a trap in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's that wonderful sense of relief after a month, 2 months, 90 days of not drinking. When you get back into the big bed, you've got money in your pocket, you're back at work, you're working better, like it says in the Vision for You. Working better, feel better, having a better time. And I fell into the trap that, well, yeah, I was a problem drinker, and I quit drinking, and that's all I have to do. And I don't need to do what you guys did. I'm really glad. I went to a lot of meetings, and I remember sitting at the meetings thinking, God, I'm glad they have this. You know? And I'd wait, and if there was a problem that I thought I could help with, I'd give my advice. And I did that for an embarrassing number of years. Really. You know, because my life was getting better. Because if you quit drinking, your life gets better. It does. For a while. So I'm, like I said, I'm in training as a physician. Why am I a doctor? Look, alcohol made every choice in my life. Every single choice. Every decision in my life, alcohol made it. I'm a doctor because alcohol and alcoholism made me a doctor. It's the truth. I was working as a ditch digger, and I'd dig ditches for a while until I had enough money to go to Mexico and live on the beach in my camper. And I'd go down to Mexico and live on the beach and drink tequila. When I ran out of money, I'd go back and dig ditches. And when I was back in the United States, I would get into trouble. The trouble was getting worse and worse. And I'd always been told that I had great potential and I was a good student and a smart guy. And I didn't like the way my life was going. So I'm laying there on the beach drinking tequila, and I say, well, you know, and this may ring a bell for some of you people that have read the literature. I want love, money, and respect. Sex, security, and society. the basic instincts. I didn't have a, you know, I thought I was figuring all this out. I didn't know this was coming from a primitive part of my brain back here that is, you know, reptilian, really, you know. I thought I was figuring it out. And I said, well, how can I get that? I said, well, obviously, I'll be a doctor. Now, I wasn't driven by any real desire to do anything for anybody but me. True. And I thought, I said to myself, it's going to be hard to be a doctor, and this is good because you will have to control your drinking. So I went back to college, and I started my course of study again. I dropped out, naturally. Wasn't everybody. And I remember going back and thinking, now I'm going to really have to work hard. I'm going to really have to pay attention. I'm going to really have to control my drinking. And in 2 months, I was studying organic chemistry at the bar with a pitcher of beer. And I did very well in college. And I got into medical school. And I remember starting my class in medical school with 88 other people and thinking, now this is the cream of the crop, the best of the best. The competition is intense now. I'm going to have to really buckle down and control my drinking. And in 2 weeks, I knew the 10% of my class that drank and drugged exactly like I did. And I drank and drugged right through medical school. I decided that I wanted to be an OBGYN doc. You guys have dirty minds. No, seriously, I love women. Delivering babies was a lot of fun. You can do big, life-saving, huge cancer surgeries if that's what you want to do. It looked like a wonderful field of medicine for me to go into. And I remember there's a point in your training where you have to fill out papers saying, this is what I want to be, and apply for a residency in that field. And I was sitting at in my house all by myself, because my first wife had left. Smart girl. All by myself, and I have this huge Jack and Coke, and I got these papers in front of me, and I'm getting ready to fill it out to go into OBGYN, and I got honest, and I said, I can't. Alcohol was running my life. I can't do it. I can't do obstetrics and gynecology. I can't be on call. I can't know that I won't be drunk when the phone rings. I can't know that my hands won't be shaking when it's time to do that surgery. I can't do it. I have to drink. I can't do this. What can I do? What am I going to do? And an answer came to me. And it was an answer from God. It truly was. God said to me, be a pathologist. Because the patients never complain. There are no emergencies. You know, there's no such thing as an emergency autopsy. Period. If you're feeling bad in the morning, you can walk into your office, shut the door, and when you feel like coming out, you can come out. You don't have to make rounds. Everything can wait. Thank God. Thank God for pathology. The good news is, how could I say God told me to do that? Well, it was a gift, because I, as a pathologist, am able to give a tremendous amount of time, the time I need to keep myself sober, to Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God. I mean, it's a miracle. It's a wonderful thing. It's a tremendous gift, and I'm very grateful. Very grateful. Good things are happening, whether you know it or not, all the time. Whether you're paying attention or not, whether you have a clue or not. If you don't think it's good, forget it. You're wrong. It's good. What's happening right now is good. True. So, I went into pathology. And honest to God, I'll tell you, the truth is, I was so deluded, that I thought, I driving to Miami to do my residency, driving to Miami with a cooler full of beer next to me, thinking, I'm going to have to get serious now. I'm going to have to control my drinking. And the plan was to move into a nice apartment with three other residents and have roommates and go to the gym and work out and work harder to work and control my drinking. And I moved into a third floor walk up in Spanish Town that I could afford with the money I was making, so I could buy the booze that I needed to drink. And I was rotating my liquor stores, so that the guys saw me, the booze wouldn't know how much I was drinking, and carrying my empties down the back stairs in the middle of the night in big black trash bags. Unbelievable. Absolutely, completely, and totally deluded. So I told you where I was at that first day of not drinking, that July 2nd, 1984. I claim that as a sobriety date because it's the last day I drank, but I was a blackout drinker, and you know, I woke up in strange situations with strange people where you go, oh my God, what happened? Oh my God. But the most amazing blackout wake up I ever had was waking up in that hospital going, oh, what have I done? You know? It was shocking. Well, anyway, I was going to tell you about mistakes, and I got off. So the first mistake was thinking that my problem was booze. I didn't pay attention. You know, Laura did such a good job of talking about what was wrong with her. By the way, I like you a lot, Lauren. You did a good job. Good job. So here I am thinking, you know, in the doctor's opinion, there's the types of alcoholics, and the last one is, he says, and then there are types that are entirely normal in every respect. They are often able, intelligent, and friendly fellows. Because a guy like that, all he's got to do is quit drinking. I'm a doctor, and I have an opinion on the doctor's opinion. I'm entitled to have one, and that particular paragraph is bullshit. I think he put it in there to make Bill feel better about himself. So, the short form of the story is, you know, after an embarrassing number of years, six, maybe seven, I don't remember for sure, I found myself, I was on the way to a Kmart to buy a shotgun to blow my brains out, and I stopped in front of a liquor store because I thought, well, if I'm going to die, why not have a drink? And so I'm sitting out there thinking about the drink and thinking, you know, a six-pack and a half pint? Jim Beam. Okay. You know, maybe I should get a quart of Jack, because it's better, and a case of beer. And I'll go to the beach. Well, domestic or imported beer. And I realized that all I wanted to do was get drunk. And all I was looking for was relief. I didn't want to die. I just wanted relief. Alcohol was my higher power. And I was allergic to it. What a terrible situation to be in. You know, if you're allergic to strawberries, you don't eat strawberries. But everybody needs a higher power. And you can't turn away from it. And I couldn't turn away from it because I had no sufficient substitute. Thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank God for all the people in all the meetings that I had been to who testified with great conviction and demonstrated through their lives the truth of their testimony, that by developing a relationship with a power greater than themselves, they had recovered from alcoholism. You know, thank you. Because it was it was that message of hope that let me go back to Alcoholics Anonymous and say, My liquor is but a symptom. There is something seriously wrong with me. Everybody is right. I mean, I got, you know, here I am, a young doctor, married to a nice-looking girl. We had a baby. We got a house. We got a better house. I got a job. I got a better job. Life is going boom like this, you know. Wonderful. Wonderful. And then the pretty wife says, well, actually, first the boss said, you're fired. And I said, why? He said, you know, you're good at your job, but we don't like you. And shortly thereafter, the wife said, get out. And I said, why? And she said, you're no good at your job, and I don't like you. I like him better. No shit. You know, and these were my problems had mounted up and become unsolvable. And it was all because of me. I wasn't drinking. I was just a shithead. But it's hard to admit that until you've heard that kind of testimony that you hear in Alcoholics Anonymous. Heard other people say, you know, let's be polite, I'm far from normal whether I'm drinking or not, and I can't manage my life. You know, lack of power, that was my dilemma. I'm powerless over alcohol. I told you that. I'm allergic to it, and I always will be. That nothing will ever change that. If I took a drink tonight, I'd be drunk tomorrow without going to sleep. I'm powerless over alcohol. Lack of power, that's my dilemma. And then it says an interesting line. It says, we had to find a power by which we could live. It doesn't say we had to find a power by which we could stop being allergic to alcohol. It says, by which we could live. And that's what working the steps in this program has allowed me to do, is form a relationship with a power greater than myself that allows me to live. My old sponsor, the guy that I ended up with after being in front of that liquor store, one of the first things he says to me, I said, will you sponsor me? How long have you been sober? 7 years. You know, 7 years. He says, well, you can probably tell me what AA's 12 steps are, right? And I said, yeah. One, we admitted we were powerless, and he said, oh my God, you're the sickest of the sick. What are you talking about? He says, AA's 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, which if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink and allow the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. And I said, wow. I said, where did that come from? And he said, third paragraph of the foreword of the 12 and 12, dummy. You know. And that established our relationship. I'm the now successful, important doctor, and he calls me dummy. And he took me through that first step. We actually worked the first three steps in the parking lot of the Newport Club in Vero Beach in about 15 minutes. And he took me through the first step, much as I've talked about it here. And then we got to the second step, and I said, well, you know, I'm not sure if I believe in God, you know, because I really don't fully understand God. And I'm confused about some things about why God would let bad things happen to good people, and I don't really know what kind of a relationship I'm supposed to have, and how could God know me and care about me personally? And he said, I'm not interested in your sophomoric dipshit ideas about God. He said, have you come to believe that the people in these rooms who have recovered from alcoholism have accessed a power greater than themselves that has restored them to sanity, and do you believe that you need the same thing? And I was able to answer yes, without a doubt. We got to the, and then the third step, he says, have you made a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of this power, whatever it is? Because he didn't want to hear any more about my ideas about God. And I said, well, that's a tall order. You know, because, well, you know, the 12 and 12 does a good job, and the short form is, if I do that, what am I, the hole in the donut? You know, and he said, oh, no, he said, you don't understand. He said, let's keep this simple for you, dummy. He said, are you willing to turn your will to drink and your miserable alcoholic life over to whatever power it is that keeps these alcoholics in these rooms sober? And I said, yes, because I was. He kept it really simple, and I'm truly grateful for that. So, this guy's name was Ennis Proctor, and he was about that tall. And he was about, I think he was 67 years old at the time. He was a huge man. He'd done his drinking in honky-tonks. He was a real bull of a human being. And I had anticipated this third step with him, and I was thinking, am I going to get down on my knees with Ennis Proctor and pray the third step prayer? I can't believe it. It was just a total disconnect. And so I stand there in the parking lot with him, and he says, I'll bet you think we're going to get down on our knees and say the third step prayer, don't you, dummy? And I said, well, and he said, nope. He said, it's not that I'm not a praying man, because I pray all the time. He said, but I'm afraid to do this with you, because I'm afraid you'll think you've done something. I'm afraid you'll think you've taken the third step. He said, if you want to take the third step, he said, I'll know you've taken the third step when you go by a 11 by 17 pad of yellow lined legal paper, and right on top of it, my name is Webb Smith, and I'm an alcoholic, a liar, a cheat, and a thief. I said, a liar, a cheat, and a thief? Me? And he said, he was ready for everything. He said, well, did you lie to your parents about your drinking? Yeah. Did you cheat them by stealing their peace of mind and their hopes and dreams for their young and beautiful son? I said, yeah. He said, did you steal money and booze from them? I said, yeah. He said, then you can probably write that down, can't you, dummy? And so I did what he said. He also said to me, he said, you know, if you really want to say a prayer, if you really want to start trying this thing, if you really want to ask God for help, why don't you go home and get that paper and pencil and get down on your knees before you write and say, please God, give me the courage to do a searching and fearless fourth step. And I did. The first time I prayed in Alcoholics Anonymous was a little different. I was attending meetings at the Alano Club and probably sober 6 months, and decided I needed a new truck. So I went to the Nissan dealership, and they let me take out a little Nissan four-wheel drive, and I drove around a little bit. They let me go alone, and I drove around a little bit, and I went into the parking lot at a bowling alley, and I got out of the truck, and I got down on my knees, and I said, God, should I buy this truck? And he said, absolutely. Absolutely. Turned out it was a great truck, like I said. Miracles, you know. I don't know. So he told me on the fourth step, I said, he said, follow the instructions in the book, and your list of people on the left-hand column should include and be, with only a rare exception, limited to your immediate family, the women you've been involved with, the people you've worked for and harmed, any individuals whose relationship with anybody you feel guilty about what you did to them, okay? Anybody you feel guilty about what you did to them, and people you are really, really pissed at, tooth grinding pissed. And so it wasn't an extremely long list. He said, write down what you're afraid of. And the sex thing was covered, because all the women I was involved with were there, you know, on that first thing. So I did it. Annis wasn't in the... He didn't hear people's fifth steps. I think it might have been a matter of time. But he used to say, I don't listen to fifth steps because I might get drunk, and when I get drunk, I talk. So he sent me to a Catholic priest who was also long sober in the program, and this was the second fourth step. I did a fourth step in the treatment center, which was Hazelden oriented. There happened to be a visiting Catholic priest, a guy named Leo B., Father Leo B., who used to be a big circuit speaker. He's a wonderful, wonderful guy, and I did it with him. But when I did it with Leo, I went over the Hazelden format, sort of. But, you know, they always say, and then you got to talk about that worst thing, you know, that thing you don't want anybody to talk ever to know, that horrible, horrible thing that you're ashamed of, embarrassed of, that awful, awful, awful thing. And I had one. And so while I'm doing my fourth step with Leo, all I could think about was this horrible thing that I was going to tell him at the end. That was it. I, my mouth is moving, and things are coming out, but my mind is thinking, oh my God, I'm going to tell him that. Oh my God, I'm going to have to say this. Holy shit. Oh my God. And he's a priest. Oh my. Oh. So I got to the end, and so that's all that's left. And I told him, and he said, that's nothing. He said, you don't even need to make amends for that. I'd effectively wasted my whole fourth step. I really did, because I was so preoccupied. And I knew that had happened. So when I went to this second Catholic priest, I started with a new worst thing, which is embarrassing in itself. And he and I talked for almost 2 hours about that. Almost 2 hours about that. And my whole disease came out. Every aspect. It was a good fifth step. And I'm glad I did the inventory. You know, I was taught that the principle behind the fifth step is integrity. And I always thought that integrity, you know, meant honor, truthfulness, you know, that kind of thing. But when I came out of that fifth step, I had a little different understanding. My understanding of integrity now is as the opposite of disintegrated. And I was disintegrated. And I think everybody who's an active or unrecovered alcoholic is disintegrated. Our parts are everywhere. There's no unity. There's no wholeness. It's this swirling mass of problems and defects and good points. But managing it is such a problem because you don't really know what's wrong. And I did that fifth step. And coming out of it, I understood that that it was no longer necessary for me to try to manage all of my individual defects of character. But what I had to do was understand that selfishness and self-centeredness was the root of my problem, and that all of my defects stemmed from that selfish, self-centered fear, that my problems were of my own making, and that they all stemmed from selfishness and self-centeredness. And that if I could be free of that, I could be free of everything. And that's a miracle. And so suddenly, there's a unity. There's a unifying principle, you know. Even if it's not a very nice one, at least things have come together, you know. But finally, I understand. Finally, I can comprehend the whole. It's manageable. And by God, life is manageable. Life is manageable. I'm powerless over alcohol, but my life is no longer unmanageable. I have a good job. I have good relationships. I'm happy. I'm useful. And I'm whole. Now, if I stopped asking for help, that would all go away immediately. All right? But I've laid hold of a power greater than myself that I can ask for help, and I always get it. Like Dr. Bob said, your Heavenly Father will never let you down. And that's been my experience. Alcoholic insanity. You know, the trivial definition of alcoholic insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. It's important to understand, but I haven't had a drink in 25 years. I've been to thousands of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I've heard the stories of thousands and thousands of alcoholics. It's very unlikely that one day I will say, that can't hurt me. I can drink that with impunity. It's not going to happen. And yet, I still suffer from alcoholic insanity. And I'll tell you what it is. Alcoholic insanity is the thought that I'm not worth it. That I'm a bad person. That you don't like me. Because why should you? Because I'm flawed, defective, and worthless. And I might as well get drunk and die. Or, so there's one, I'm not worth it. And the other one is, the world sucks. It's not fair. None of this is my fault. This shit is happening to me it's just not right. I can't stand it anymore. I might as well get drunk and die. I'm an alcoholic, and that means that left to my own devices, I will die with something round, cold, and hard in my mouth. And it will be the end of a bottle or the end of a gun. But, oh, and let me tell you, 25 years, and there are black times still. There are black times still. And in those times, I say, please God, remove this thought from my head. Please God, let me know without a doubt that I am your child and basically good, basically. And that this is your world and it's perfect. Now that prayer has saved my life. Saved my life. I used to take a drink to save my life, and now I say a prayer to save my life, and it's that simple. It's that simple. Alcoholics Anonymous, in the end, is all about love. It's about loving God and letting God love you and it's about loving your fellows in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we're talking about non-romantic love here, all right? And Ennis Proctor told me that I should read a book called The Art of Loving by a guy named Eric Fromm. And I bought it and I read it, but I remember when Ennis told me about it. And what Ennis said was, he said, Eric Fromm says that there are four elements to non-romantic love, and they are care, respect, responsibility, and knowledge. And you know, when you get a when you get a newcomer like Laura, for instance, that comes up here and tells her story, you know, think back to when she walked into the room. You cared about her. You cared about her because you knew what was wrong with her. You knew how she was suffering. And you don't want her or anybody else to die. And she comes around, and at 1 minute, oh my God, she comes around. Holy shit. So we'll do this fast. So she comes around and she keeps coming back, and you develop some respect for her. This is a person who wants this. And then you say, my God, I've recovered from alcoholism. I have responsibility. Like it says in the family afterward, we have recovered and been given the power to help others. Holy shit. And then you say, and I have some knowledge to impart because I've worked these steps and I know how it goes and I know how to help another individual. And that's love. And that's what we do here. And it's beautiful. And I thank you all for loving me. Cheers.